You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day, I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions, because you know I told you, and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is as a gamer. He's a baller. He's a playmaker. And a shot-caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. Across the table from me, looking sharp today in a nice half zip sweater with a collar underneath.
Wearing my Villanova colors.
The immortal Neil Payne. Hello, Neil.
How you doing, Chad?
Good. And on the other line, afar, across that whole country, Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Chad.
How are you?
Hi, Neil.
Hey, Kate.
Kate. I wish I was there to see you in all your Villanova garb.
Kate, where are we talking to you?
From Portland, Oregon.
Ooh.
From the Ace Hotel in Portland, Oregon.
How fancy. Very startup-y of you. Yeah, I was
going to
say.
I'm very hipster.
You're disrupting Portland. So I want to apologize to both of you. For the last couple podcasts, I've been calling you my erstwhile colleagues.
Ooh.
Several Hot Takedown listeners have emailed, tweeted, etc., to let me know that erstwhile means former. And I thought it just meant, you know, stalwart. I think I meant stalwart colleagues. So I'm sorry to both of you. I want you to know that I wasn't trying to push you out the door.
Apology accepted, Chad.
Thanks.
Good thing neither of us knew what the word meant either.
Yeah, so. Maybe it proves all of our negligence. One more announcement before we get going. In this show, Neil and I have a new podcast.
Oh, that's true.
It's called Panic City, and it's for all the Mets fans out there like you, Kate Fagan, because we didn't want to pollute Hot Takedown with even more Mets talk than we already do.
We've seceded into our own show.
Yes. So listener,
wait, so no more Mets talk?
No, we're still going to, I mean, Kate, come on. We're still going to talk
about
the Mets.
Because you guys can't talk Mets without me sometimes.
That's exactly. Kate, we want you on Panic City.
Okay.
So Panic City is it's an off-brand podcast. It's not related to the 538 Empire. It just has me and Neil as its two yakkers. And the conceit, Neil, do you want to explain what the whole conceit is?
Yeah, so Panic City, of course, being what Sandy Alderson described us Mets fans as being denizens of. And in each episode, one of us will be panicked about something, and one of us will talk the other one off the ledge.
Or perhaps
push off the ledge. We'll kind of both take a flying leap together.
Holding hands. With our Statman capes flapping behind us.
Flapping in the wind.
Hey, I also have my own podcast now that you guys are mentioning it.
This is a burgeoning empire of Hot Takedown spinoffs.
Yes. All the spinoffs. We're like Frasier over here. I'm narrating a podcast for the Dunkumentary series. Mine is about the first women's dunk and how the game footage was almost lost to history. But
oh my God.
It's a five-part series, and it's from ESPN Audio. And it's awesome.
Cool. Well, so do you want to spoil it? What almost happened to it? Or should people just listen
and
find out?
No. I mean, no. People have to listen.
Okay.
This is too good a story to squeeze into a little soundbite. It's a full 20-minute story, Chad.
Excellent. So, listeners, go to your apps right now. We know you're playing games while you're listening to this anyway. And, you know, Candy Crush, Bejeweled, whatever else. Go to your podcast app instead. Search for Dunkumentaries, like Dunk. And documentaries, and download especially Kate Fagan's episode, but all the episodes.
All of them.
And then you Mets fans out there, Panic City, a Mets podcast by Neil and me. All right, the actual Hot Takedown show begins. Here's what's going to come up on it. We are still buzzing over the final moments of the NCAA men's tournament final. We will make sense of Villanova's run through the tournament, all the things that had to go right on that final play, and whether the stats have anything to tell us about singular moments like those, or if we should just revel in the moment for what it was. Last week, five players on the U.S. women's national team filed a federal complaint against U.S. soccer because what they felt was wage discrimination. Allison McCann will join us to discuss the case and whether men and women should be paid equally, even when these collective bargaining agreements say that women should be paid less. And then our significant digit. It's going to be about the Golden State Warriors and their chase for history. And Neil, I think you are presenting.
I am presenting my first Sig Dig.
Ooh.
I think this might
exciting.
Be the first.
Excellent.
So, yeah,
And then we will do a quick update of the Bracket Challenge. Now that the Bracket Challenge has come to its completion, those T-shirts are just itching to get out the door. The T-shirts, of course, of Adam Silver riding a bear into a pool of fish. That fixes the NBA Draft Lottery. Okay, on to the final of the men's NCAA tournament. Let's get into the mood. Let's listen to the call.
With Archie Diacono, 3 seconds at midcourt.
Jenkins
gives it to Jenkins for the championship.
Very impassioned Jim Nance on that play.
How about those onions? So, I love the gunshots of the confetti going off.
Yeah,
in that
it's
clip.
Very disconcerting when you don't have the context of the actual event itself.
So that was the call on the final play of the game in Houston last night, as Chris Jenkins won the game for the Villanova Wildcats. The Wildcats had a 6% chance of winning when the tournament started. According to 538 projections, that was sixth highest in the entire field, and they were a 2-seed, don't forget. And they beat 3 of the 5 teams that were ahead of them in championship odds on their way to the championship. So am I wrong to be extremely impressed given that?
No, I mean, I don't think that's wrong at all, given the fact that this year we had talked about it before the tournament that it was such a wide-open year. There were so many teams that could plausibly win the championship, and we really kind of hemmed and hawed and didn't know how to declare a favorite because there didn't seem to be a favorite. Villanova almost made the statement of, hey, guys, I'll just beat all of the other teams that you guys are bandying about as being favorites, and we'll be the champions.
And it does feel, too, like when it's such a wide-open field like we saw, like we talked about 3 weeks ago, then I think it does come into play, like, seniority and how much maturity Villanova had and that they were playing in a way that had them at least, and I know we hate the word momentum, but they were playing better at this moment in time than they played earlier in the season and then a lot of other programs were playing. So I think some of that comes into play, especially when you look at, like, they were in the top 10 in defensive and offensive efficiency, but nobody was really paying attention to that because we didn't see the kind of the key moments from them throughout the year that maybe we saw from the Kansas and we saw from North Carolina, like those games where they get on SportsCenter and everybody's buzzing about them. Like, Villanova didn't have those moments, so they seem kind of overlooked, but yet when they get into the tournament, they're playing at a level that maybe a lot of us didn't expect, and it was at the absolute right moment.
Yeah, and if you need any kind of indication of that, I think it's kind of encapsulated by the games that they played against Oklahoma. In December, they lost to them 78-55, and then in the Final Four, they turned around and absolutely crushed them by 44 points, 95-51.
So I want to dwell on the seniority point for a second, because it does seem to me like if you don't have one team that's going to blow out the field of talent the way that Kentucky did last year until they ran into Wisconsin, at least, you are going to be caught into a few tight situations. Any team is going to run into tight situations on their way to the championship. Interestingly enough, except for UNC maybe until last night's game, but Villanova against Kansas, Villanova in last night's game, though there were moments in which a less senior team, if you buy into seniority, especially for college athletes, mattering, and I think maybe I do, that those are moments of, those are crisis moments, right? We saw this happen with, was it Northern Iowa and Texas A&M, where people who were new to the situation just totally folded in themselves. Villanova didn't have that happen.
Maybe so, but if you look at our friend Kim Pomeroy, he's the dean of college basketball stats. Today will probably be the last time in a while that we talk about him on the podcast. He keeps some stats for experience, team experience, which is just, you know, the number of years that the players have played, weighted by the minutes that they, you know, contributed to the team, and then also continuity. And that, I think, is the really interesting one, because Villanova ranked about 100th in continuity, roundabout, and also in experience. But the teams, if you look at some of the teams they beat Kansas, Kansas, who were 10th in continuity. They beat Oklahoma, who were 18th in continuity. They beat North Carolina, who were 12th in continuity. So they were actually going through teams that, if you're kind of making the argument that these should be cohesive units and they kind of fall back or on their team spirit or their teamwork or whatever, that those teams should have actually had a stronger profile against Villanova, but Villanova just beat them. And I think maybe another stat that speaks to Villanova's teamwork in a sort of different angle is just how balanced they were in terms of the offensive share being spread out across a bunch of different players. They had six players in their top six players by minutes. All of those guys had between 20 and 23.5% of the team's offense flow through them. So an average player on a team would have 20% because you take 100% divided by five players. And for champions in the past, you typically see a team have a guy that's near 30%. Like Jahlil Okafor for Duke last year was around 29%. So it's kind of remarkable the fact that they have so many guys that are so bunched together, and each of them is playing a role, but they're playing a pretty sizable role to have everyone kind of slotted in that way on the team. And I think you saw that in the last, sequence of events in that game.
Yeah, exactly. Like the last play, to me, is not a play that comes to fruition as easily if you've got a team that is heavily dominant on one player or has somebody who has, like you said, like a 30% usage rate, because all of a sudden, psychologically, that player, if he or she is still on the floor, thinks, this is my shot, this has to be my shot. The defense is thinking, this is his or her shot, it has to be his or her shot. And you end up with likely a poorer shot, or if that person passes it up because it's not a good shot, then you've got a bunch of other role players who maybe aren't mentally prepared for the moment. But you look at Villanova from the second that they called that timeout before the final play up into Jenkins taking the shot, and you kind of get this sense that everybody on the floor is kind of prepared for the moment because you don't have the one guy who you kind of shifted and you're leaning toward, and that kind of skews everybody's preparation for the play.
So let's talk about that one play. I'm trying to make sense of whether or not numbers and analytics have anything to tell me about that one play that's now going to be replayed at every tournament or not, because it's such a confluence of events that lead us to the circumstances that make that play possible and make it ripe to happen, basically. So you need Marcus Paige to hit that insane sort of three-pointer where
double clutch.
I mean, and his knees were folded up parallel to the ground, basically, as he let that let that ball go, it goes in. You need you need UNC to be 11 of 17 from three in that game to bring it to a tie game late in the game. I'm saying game a lot here. You need Chris Jenkins to have a certain efficiency rate from 3-point. And like, do stats tell me anything, or was it just a singular moment where some stuff happened and we could rejoice in the moment and just let it be that?
It seems like that to me, that final 5 seconds is totally separate in a way from the Paige shot, because it was a standalone play that was designed, that it seemed like Villanova and their preparation and who they are as a team was able to execute. I get the idea that like it couldn't have happened unless Paige hit that shot, but like all of those different things created the game. But like that 5 second moment, I do think stands alone as representative in a way of kind of what Villanova was about.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that I don't know what the stats can tell you about it or what have you, but I do know that going back to what you said, and we were talking about the balance of the team, that Archie Diacono, he apparently, they practice this play all the time, I think it's even called Nova is the name of the play, I think I read. And he is given the ability to sort of, see what the defense gives him and make decisions off of that.
It's
and
like
that's
a read option almost for both.
Yeah, a little bit. Because of the way that they are so balanced, he had a lot of viable options on that play. And let's be perfectly clear. Chris Jenkins, who trailed the play, the Carolina defenders got kind of mixed up on that Ochefu screen, and they, no one knew exactly who was going to be covering Jenkins, and he kind of went down and was able to get the clean look. He was their leading 3-point shooter during the season. He made 100 threes and hit 39% of them. This was absolutely by design to have him be the inbounder. And a lot of times, I mean, coaches will tell you, the defenses forget about the inbounder. The inbounder is invisible sometimes because you're so worried about who has the ball and who you're defending that in the actual court, that even coming down, you know, the trail man is a very dangerous person on those types of plays. And to have it be Jenkins and have it be somebody that actually is your best three-point shooter made that play possible, and he did what he's, you know, done all season long. He knocked down the three.
Yeah, I mean, when I was in college, when we had baseline out-of-bounds plays, it was always the shooting guard that took the ball out of bounds simply because the very motion of passing the ball on bounds like created such a diversion of attention, and everybody would watch the ball, and you would dart off some other angle and almost always be open on the reverse side if, like, they could kick it around quick enough. So you're totally right, Neil, on, like, that Jenkins trailing the play and being where he was specifically because he could hit that shot.
So your point is that analytics inform the play because of the percentages that go into it? My articulation, maybe a better articulation of what I was trying to say, is it seems to me like singular moments in sports sort of are a safe space from stats and analytics, because they either happen
or
they
don't.
Come on,
do we need to have trigger warnings for stats and analytics?
No, because it's, I mean, we talk about small sample size, yada, yada, all the time, but this is a singular moment, the shot goes in or it doesn't go in, and there are some percentages that underlie it, but it just seems to me like this was in its rawest form, just like an incredible event. And that incredible event, does it have anything to do with advanced stats and advanced analytics?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's a play that was make or miss and could have gone either way, and then they would have gone into overtime, and that's a whole different thing. But I think also, if you look, we talked about the way Villanova had beat, who they had beaten and how they had beaten them throughout the tournament. And, you know, often I think when we talk about championship games, we're talking about, and small samples, especially in a one-and-done tournament like the NCAA tournament, we're talking about things like, did this tournament yield the best team as the champion, and does that matter? Do we care about that? Villanova, you know, we at 538 keep our own power ratings throughout the year, and after updating the power rating, I don't have the exact number in front of me, but UNC and Villanova were so close going into the game that I would be surprised that after that victory, if not Villanova was considered the best team. So in a way, they played themselves to it, and that shot sort of made manifest something that kind of the stats also showed, which was they may not have been considered the best team going into the tournament, but having beaten and provided all this evidence that they were better than we considered them to be during the tournament, that now they're the best team, and the best team is the one that won. And that's not always the case in the NCAA, but
and I also
this time
think that like there are certain shots at the end of games, like probably pages, where analytically, and it would take a lot of data to figure it out, like that whole play is a very low percentage outcome that it ends in a three-pointer.
Oh, yeah, after the Villanova guy fell on the ground and, like, all of that stuff.
But even a lot of, like, our famous game-winning shots, like the Leitner turnaround, there are these singular moments, but they also seem to me like they're a construction of a play that you could not replicate a lot. If you really look at the Villanova play, like, and how it could be set up, it seems like one of the most high-percentage, like, pre-calculated, perfectly executed end-of-game plays in such a high-pressure moment that I've seen possibly ever.
That's interesting. Yeah, the NC State, the famous NC State, missed three and then dunk.
Right, that's not drawn up.
It's a broken play.
Nothing
right.
could have predicted.
Right, but
yeah.
your point is that plays are drawn up so that they maximize the odds of being successful. And so maybe analytics are underlying them.
Or at least the coach thinks that they are. And he,
right,
you know,
right, right,
we
right.
don't know if Jay Wright looked at the percentages before he drew up that play, but he definitely had something like that in mind when they called it.
Excellent. Okay, so let's leave it there. We're recording this on Tuesday afternoon before the Women's Championship, but that doesn't mean we're not going to talk about the Women's Championship. We thought about doing a segment about UConn's fourth straight championship for this podcast.
Just before it happens,
be it rude. You know, I think it's 97% UConn to beat Syracuse, according to 538. Anyways, but we're not going to do that. We're going to be back on Wednesday morning. Doing a little flash pod to talk about the women's final. So look in your hot takedown feed for that. On to women's soccer, where the data on men's and women's pay is starkly unequal. The complaint by Hope Solo, Carly Lloyd, Becky Sauerbrunn, Alex Morgan and Megan Rapinoe has brought a lot of attention to the amounts that players are paid based on their collective bargaining agreements on both the men's and women's side of U.S. soccer. We do not talk about women's soccer without Allison McCann. Allison McCann, welcome back to Hot Takedown.
Hello, I'm glad to be back.
Okay, let me just run through some numbers real quick, and then we'll get into the heart of things. Let's do World Cup bonuses per player. We'll take first place since the women actually won the World Cup. Each player on the women's World Cup team got $75,000 as a bonus. The men, if they had won the World Cup, would have gotten $390,625 each. The women got less than a fifth of what the men would have gotten. Per diem for traveling. This is a fun one. For domestic venues, the women get $50 a day. For men, $62.50. It's much more expensive to be a man than a woman out in the road.
It is. $12.50 more expensive.
Yes. Yeah.
Per day, apparently.
And then exhibition games, so friendlies, similar disparity in pay. For playing, you get $3,600 as a woman, $5,000 as a man. If you win, you get a bump on top of that. The bump for men is much larger. There's a trend here. So it's clearly unequal, but the women players said yes to this in some way because they signed a collective bargaining agreement. Right, Allison? Is that uncharitable to say, well, they signed up for the pay that they're getting, and so, you know, do they have rights to bring a complaint based on that?
So they haven't signed a new CBA since 2006.
Okay.
There are only 6 active players on that signing. So right now they have what's called like a memorandum of understanding. They basically said that their old CBA expired in 2012. They kind of came to this agreement, this temporary one. And then in December they actually filed a formal complaint saying this is, you know, no longer, we are not agreeing to this as like a fake CBA. We don't have a CBA right now. So they're, you know, the players are sort of operating under, we do not have a CBA, and U.S. Soccer is operating under, yes, you do, this memorandum is a CBA.
So that's why they feel justified in bringing the complaint.
Yeah, so I guess it depends which side of that agreement you're on. If you think that that CBA is valid or the temporary thing, then yes, they did agree to these terms. If you do not think it's valid, then...
Yeah, a lot of times it seems like in other sports when we see this, it leads to some kind of like strike or lockout type of situation where there's no CBA, there's no games happening. Is it possible that we would see a situation where like there is, I mean, I guess there would be a women's national team, but it would not have any of the players that we know and love from the women's national team? And would they just go on with that? Or is there any indication of like how much hardball they're, that's going to be played between them? Or are they just going to kind of keep going with this weird provisional memorandum of understanding or whatever?
Yeah, it seems like, you know, this, that part of this, you know, current wage discrimination lawsuit is coming at a time when they are clearly trying to bargain for a new CBA. But that was precisely why in December they said that this thing no longer exists, to say that we are not bound by a no strike clause. So,
oh, that was one of the clauses,
yes,
in their thing.
Okay, correct. So that is sort of where everybody's sort of thinking about now, is that would that be the most, you know, drastic form of this? But it was clearly something that they were putting on the table. So yeah, it's definitely possible.
Well, it's also a lot more complicated than it seems like on the headline grab level. And Allison, I'd love for you to jump in on this, because of course there's the FIFA World Cup payout numbers, which are drastically different on the men's side and the women's side. But then there's the added wrinkle of the fact that U.S. Soccer funds the salaries for their national team players who are in the NWSL Professional League, and they're on contracts rather than getting paid a la carte. Now, there's some discrepancies that just boggle the mind, and I'm sure those are the ones that have fueled a lot of this decision-making process from the women's players, like you guys mentioned, like the per diem and, I'm assuming, field conditions as well as travel conditions that fuel a lot of this within U.S. Soccer. But it is very interesting and complicated when you add in the professional league issues.
Yeah, absolutely. I think also trying to draw comparisons to other sports with CBA is difficult due to the, you know, cyclical nature of soccer, and their revenue from a World Cup year and an Olympic year to the next year for these teams is, you know, insanely different. So trying to, like, you know, draw a comparison with a major sports league in which they play the same number of games, you know, every year for the most part. So, yeah, I do think this complicates all of these sort of questions of.
The social like meme that went around or placard that was like equal pay for equal play. I mean, like, I almost feel like, and Abby Wambach even mentioned this, like, they just want to open up the books because they might open up the books and see that they're not maximizing profits on the women's side as well as they could be, or they're making even more money, projected to make even more money next year than we even dreamed. And there could be an issue where, like, they actually make more money going forward than the men, at which point wouldn't we want them to be paid even more than the men are paid? Or do we feel like because this is a national team and you can't just, like, go play for another country that everybody should be making equal?
Right. So a Wall Street Journal article wrote that U.S. soccer in February estimated that women's national team was going to generate $17.16 million between April of this year and March of next year, so $17.6 million, and the men in fewer matches were going to generate $9 million in revenue. And so equal pay for equal play, there is an equal play going on, partly because the women are playing more matches or on tour more.
Yeah, this, you know, I think they have an extreme amount of leverage this year that they will be the only U.S. soccer team at the Olympics, the men's team, which is actually under 23, but still under this pyramid of U.S. soccer, did not qualify for the Olympics in Rio. So I think they U.S. soccer is going to rely very heavily on the women's team, you know, for this year, and then kind of will switch over to the men's side once it's their World Cup year. So it does seem very strange to be having these conversations as this one governing body over both of two teams that are doing two entirely different things.
And we also, you know, kind of the women's side is more, vastly more successful. And it was watched more, you know, when they defeated Japan to win the World Cup, it was seen by a record 25 million viewers on Fox, which was a record if you include the men's or the women's side for viewership here in the U.S. So I think by any metric, they are a far more successful team. They're the real U.S., you know, national soccer team in a lot of senses. So, yeah, the discrepancy, if we're talking about the fact that, you know, revenue generated or interest generated in the game, I think they definitely can make a case for that. My question is, how much of that should even be sort of the conversation, or should we just say it's ridiculous that you do have, you know, run by the same federation, the pay, you know, is it immaterial that the women's team is actually more profitable in some sense or more viewed or more popular? And should we just say this is wrong that the men's and women's side are paid differently, or should that be play into it? Because a lot of people are saying, you know, we had a conversation about the tennis and about how, well, if the men's side makes more, then they should get more money. And I don't know what the answer is, but it seems like it should kind of be immaterial if they're reasonably close to each other in terms of revenue generated.
And it seems like also, Neil, if only one thing happens from this, it kind of brings up the question about how women's teams and female athletes are marketed and whether they're marketed as interestingly and as intensely as they are on the men's side. Because here you've got a U.S. national soccer team that draws a ton of eyeballs and there is a market for them and they do win. And if soccer and U.S. soccer isn't able to capitalize on that in a way, you've got a perfect test case for how even saying whether it's like an argument of like revenue-based or market-based for how you pay somebody, well, then you have to look at whether the market is actually biased in some way, because this is a team that should be making tons of money. And if U.S. soccer isn't putting the kind of effort into getting and maximizing all of that, well, then that's interesting as well.
Yeah, I agree completely with Kate. I think as to what you were saying, Neil, a lot of the conversation has been around they have yet to surpass in revenue. So these, you know, projections for the upcoming year are the first year that I think the women would potentially bring in more money than the men. So, you know, a lot of the detractors are sort of pointing to that, well, they have yet to, you know, bring in more money, and they've yet to bring in more viewers on a consistent basis. You know, like, we can have these sort of extreme examples, but I think that, yes, I'm sort of in the camp that this is all immaterial, because if you're saying, you know, revenue should be based on what, yeah, exactly, what marketers, what fans, what apparel, what advertisers are placing, you know, value on this team, then you're in a entirely different, you know, complicated nature of market, you know, what the market values this thing. And that, you know, doesn't matter to me as much as just paying people equally for doing the same work.
Well, and we've talked a lot on the show about the narratives that go on around women's sports versus around men's sports, and whether or not it's fair to say, well, men's sports make more money in the first place, as though it happens in a vacuum. You know, that there are institutional factors that are leading up to why perhaps people watch more men's tennis than women's tennis globally or something like that. What's interesting to me about women's soccer is that here's an example of a women's sport that's breaking that paradigm a little bit. And, you know, I think while the Women's World Cup was going on, I feel like women's soccer, and Allison, tell me if this is just sort of rose into glasses, is the one women's team sport that really gets covered with the narratives about the players and whatever else as it's happening, at least, you know, as the major events are happening, in the way that the men's national team does when the Men's World Cup is happening.
Yeah, absolutely. Or even an argument for more, because they'll play more games and they'll go on victory tours and stuff. So yeah, I think that they are, you know, in a super interesting position to be probably the only, you know, sports team for women to be able to bring a lawsuit against their employer, you know. And I think it's, you know, kind of funny for U.S. soccer to come back being like, we are, you know, the world leader in women's soccer. Like, that, I don't know if we should be handing out trophies for people that are, you know, in charge of women's soccer federations, like, just based on everything that's going on at FIFA, if that is your standard to not even pay equally. But yeah, so I think it's a really good move for them. It's exactly the right timing with everything that's coming up. And
so what real quick, because then we have to move on to the next segment. What's going to happen next? Is there a timeline to things? Is it? I mean, so the U.S. soccer has sort of denied that this is unfair. They haven't denied the numbers that I read at the top of the segment, but they've said. They haven't said that, you know, we're going to change things immediately. So what happens next?
So I guess I'm not really totally clear on the timing of when you file a complaint to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, how fast they turn that things around. But I guess they wait to see if they, you know, it will go to court. That seems like, I would imagine it would be settled in a way, you know, because they have their league starting in 2.5 weeks or less, that U.S. soccer also pays the salary of players to play in that league. And then they have the Olympics this summer. So
so lots of events on the calendar.
Calendar, yes. Yes. But that's what I think. But who knows, if both continue to say the other is in the wrong, then maybe nothing will happen.
Okay. Very good. Allison McCann, thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
All right, now to Significant Digit. We're going to do it without Kate, who had to run to take care of something in Oregon. May we all have such glamorous to-do list items. Neil Payne has brought us our Significant Digit, which is a telling number from the world of sports this week. Neil, what have you brought us?
Our Sig Dig this week is timely because of the comments made by Scottie Pippen about how his 1996 Bulls would sweep the current Golden State Warriors. We crunched some numbers and we estimated the probability that the 96 Bulls would sweep the Warriors if the two played 7 games on a neutral court. And we even adjusted the two teams' numbers for era. That significant digit is 10.6%. That's the chance. Now, I should also put a just truckload of caveats on that. That we are not talking about playing styles or differences in the, you know, the physical makeup of the two teams. A lot of the commentary on the Warriors versus those Bulls seems to be grounded in the fact that the Warriors are, you know, kind of a small ball based team. They shoot a lot of threes. It would be different having to face the Bulls, who have Luke Longley in the lineup and you know, a bigger team. Scottie Pippen would be able to. People have said that he might defend Curry. I'm not so sure about that. But certainly the styles would be different. But if you just look at the quality of the two teams relative to the leagues in which they played, and longtime listeners will note, we also have an adjustment for the difficulty of each league season in the NBA from when I went on my rant about the comments by Bob Sarver about how millennials are ruining the NBA. We were able to kind of look at a comparison between two leagues. The 1996 NBA was a less difficult league than the 2016 NBA by about a half a point per team possession.
Okay, so 10.6% chance.
Mm-hmm.
that the Warriors, sorry, that the Bulls would sweep the Warriors.
Now, to beating them, as part of this calculation, we went through all the permutations. So the most common one was Bulls win in six games, 19.6% chance of that. Second most common was Bulls win in five games, that's 18.2%. If you add up all the ones, Bulls would win 65% of the time, Warriors would win about 35%.
Now, that's using the ELO rankings and whatever else?
That's using box plus minus, which is a rating that sort of takes into account, it rates each player on the team, and then you can kind of combine it for a team rating. But the reason I used it was to do this timeline adjustment by which I could say, how much more difficult is it to play in 2016 than 1996?
So if the Warriors, for example, win four out of five games going forward, does their box plus minus change to the point where all of a sudden they're going to be much more likely to beat the 96 Bulls?
I don't know how much I would say much more. I mean, it's grounded in how the team performs on the season level. So, you know, the Warriors this year, you know, for all of the number of wins they have and this chase for the record, in terms of efficiency differential, which is just point margin per 100 possessions, which is what box plus minus and a bunch of other stats are grounded in, they're not number one in the league this year. They're plus 11 per 100 possessions. Number one is San Antonio, who is plus 12.3 per 100 possessions. That's kind of what's going on here, is that the Warriors, you know, it's kind of amazing, actually. We're all talking about the record and the fact that the Warriors, you know, seem unbeatable in terms of wins and losses. But really, they, according to a metric that is a more predictive indicator of how teams do in the playoffs, they haven't been the best team in the NBA this year, and it's not even especially close. They've just won some close games, and they've also put players in the game. They've been up and blown people out and been ahead so much that, you know, it can drag down mm-hmm. your efficiency differential if you have a lot of garbage time. So credit to them to that. But if you're just looking at it straight up, I mean, if you made an adjustment for garbage time, it would bring them closer. But I'm still not sure that, you know, even if San Antonio, for instance, at 12.3 is not ahead of where the Bulls were. Bulls were about plus 13 per 100 possessions, which I think is the best any team has ever had that year. That was a really good team. I mean, Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and the rest of the
crew. You don't have to argue for how good the 96 Bulls were. Yeah. It's okay. That goes without saying. So we should just give our listeners a quick rundown of what's going to happen for the Warriors in their next five games. They play the Grizzlies twice, the Timberwolves once, and the Spurs twice.
Those Spurs.
According to 538 projections.
And you never know what those Spurs are going to do. Greg Popovich could. I would not be stunned at all if he didn't play any of his players and let the Warriors kind of walk over them in a mind game for the playoffs.
So absent any of that, any of those sort of inputs into our model, we think that the Warriors have a 60% chance of breaking the Bulls 96 wins record and a 16.2% chance of finishing with 74 wins.
But a 0% chance of making people like Scottie Pippen and Charles Barkley and all of those guys not talk junk about them.
That was very politely put, not talk junk.
I had to shift gears at the last second.
All right, so stay tuned for more Warriors talk on Hot Takedown, I am sure. All right, now a final men's bracket update. We'll do a women's bracket update tomorrow. So we brought in our producer, our stalwart producer.
Not erstwhile.
Joe Sykes.
Although if he keeps up this Yankees talk, he might be.
Go Yankees.
Oh, God. All right, Joe, what do you got for us?
Okay, so remember we had over 1,300 brackets in the group, and we have a winner. So VU80, congratulations. You won, and it's an odd name, I'm not going to lie. But VU80 has won a T-shirt.
A T-shirt of Adam,
Silver
riding a bear.
Congratulations!
Into a pool of fish. He also came. He or she, sorry, came 2,683rd out of 13 million.
Wow.
In the country.
That's quite good.
And picked Villanova to win 72-68, which is not a bad prediction.
Not far,
I would say.
What it ended up being.
And who was the most loserist?
Well, the loserist.
Most losers.
Member of the bracket. We've mentioned before, Cellar Dweller. So Cellar Dweller came out with a great name.
The Holy Cross, Victor.
Yeah, and Cellar Dweller came out on the bottom. So Cellar Dweller will also be receiving a T-shirt. We will find you, VU80 and Cellar Dweller, and we will provide T-shirts. Now, before we end this, I have one more update for you all. And that's the little mini challenge we've been kind of taking part in ourselves in this, you know, hot takedown bracket challenge.
Joe, I mean, the listeners can hear the cockiness in your voice, and they find it unbecoming of an august Britishman like yourself.
In last place is Jab Matlin, tied 263rd. Not very good, Chad. Come on, you could have done better than that. In third, Kate Fagan, tied 109th. Pretty good, I'd say. In second, Stathead Neil Payne, tied 68th. I mean, for a stathead like yourself, who's, you know, been studying basketball for since you were, you know, in diapers, I'm not sure that that's...
Well, Joe, I mean, 68th out of 1,300. By the way, I sent you a screenshot during one of the games because I knew that Villanova had gotten all the points that it could after it won the Oklahoma game in the semis. I sent you a screenshot showing my peak position, which I think was roundabout where you finished, actually.
Let's close this
peak
out.
Peak positions don't here, mean guys. Anything. Who do you think won the bracket? Who's the only person left? Who's the only person left? Who haven't I mentioned?
Tony Chow.
Not Tony Chow. Joe Sykes. Tied for 13th in the 99th percentile.
Congratulations, Joe.
Joe, how many games of college basketball had you watched before this tournament?
Zero.
Joe,
zero games,
there's nothing
Chad.
To be proud of.
Zero games.
You know how to click some buttons on a website.
I just gamed the bracket the first time ever. Thank you, Hot Takedown listeners. I look forward to your tweets and emails and videos if anyone wants to make any videos about
All right, that'll do it for this week's show. Kate Fagan says thank you to us, and we say thank you to Kate Fagan and Absentia. Neil, thank you.
Thanks, Chad.
You did a much better job than our producer on today's show.
I should say so.
Our podcast producer is no longer with us. He was once known as Joe Sykes. Our podcast overlord is Jody Alvergan. We get production assistance from Tony Chow. Our intern, our former intern, is Jonathan Yales. He still helps out with the show. We get production assistance from Jonathan Yales, along with Tony Chow. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. Find us on all sorts of podcasting apps, iTunes, of course, as well. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. Be sure to review and or rate the show while you're there. It helps others discover the program. 538 has other podcasts. We've got an election podcast. We've got a data in society podcast. Search for 538 in iTunes. Find those. And as we mentioned earlier, Dunkumentaries, a 5-part series about the dunk that Kate Fagan is narrating one part of, and Panic City, a Mets podcast featuring Neil Payne and myself. Find it all on iTunes. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin, the loser of the Hot Takedown Men's Tournament Challenge Bracket. I'll talk to you next time.